You're listening to The Cowboy Pages. Come with me, Christy Crowley, as I travel America in search of cowboy poets and their wisdom. Today's book, South Dakota, Chapter 4, You Can Riot with a Bullet. A continuation of my chat with rancher and poet, Linda Heselstrom.
And I'm going to tell you about this. This is where the stories come from. And it's dedicated to Wally McCrae and Joel Nelson, who are two of the finest cowboy poets in the world, because I heard the two of them talking. And I heard one line, and then I turned away because I thought it was impolite to eavesdrop on them. And everything else about this poem came out of my imagination. But that one line came from one of them, and neither one of them can remember which one it was. So it's dedicated to both of them. This is where the stories come from. You didn't know? He died, young and hard and bad. That voice could fill a stadium, but he spoke low and flicked a glance beneath his Stetson brim at me. I turned away, but I'd already heard enough. The tale began to grow, to put down roots within my brain, already thick with other tales. I chose this job of telling stories, counting lives gone by too soon. What I don't know, I'll guess. I suppose his father made him tough by being cold and rugged. He learned to be a man by never showing fear. His mom spent all her time alone, fixing meals and counting hours in that old ranch house 2 dozen miles from town, before she met the guitar picker she ran off with when the boy was 10. His dad bought him a pickup when he finished high school, took the boy to his first fancy bar. His sister got advice to go to school, find herself a husband, settle down, and have some kids. I didn't hear enough to know if it was drugs or drink that got this one, but I can see him gun a graveled curve on some Montana back road, laughing fit to kill as headlights sweep around the bend, baffled when the stars come down to meet him. I can hear the crash. I wonder, did he leave some girl in terror, pregnant with the memory of his grin? Does his dad just drink and stare at empty spaces where he hoped for family, settled on the land that bore his name? I heard a bit of talk I wasn't meant to hear, and now I can't get rid of it. I might as well get dressed and write it down. I'll sleep no more tonight.
Thank you. Thank you, thank you.
Where the Stories Come From is a poem I just love. I was thrilled to have Linda recite it for me. It's a great and gritty story for sure, but it's filled with so many incredible lines. The line that hit me the first time I read it, and the one that always gets me, is, did he leave some girl in terror, pregnant with the memory of his grin? Oh, gives me chills. I brought up that line in particular, and it launched us into our conversation on language, art, and Linda's ability to make a world appear in just a few words.
As a lover of language, I mean, there are just certain lines that you kind of just pluck out. And I with my actor friends, we kind of geek out over, you know, specific little lines. And that's one of them.
Oh,
and I had a conversation with a good friend of mine. She just did a one-woman show about her pregnancy. I told her that line, and you could just see it hit
wow.
her chest, because she knows exactly what it feels like to be
that
expectant
person.
I
don't,
you know.
But I accept.
I mean, you could
identify.
Just see that little spark of terror. Here I am.
Oh, that's good.
You know, and
I'm so glad to know that. Thank you.
Yeah,
what a gift
really,
that is.
It's a really cool thing. The other thing you said this morning was, you can write with a bullet. And I thought, man, that's a line.
The guys loved it.
That is a line.
The guys especially love it. The women kind of go,
wait, what? Yeah. But I thought, ooh, that's...
And sometimes I have said, and I didn't state that we always had bullets in the car. Now, we didn't do a lot of shooting, but we quite often, especially after my husband George was here, we learned to take a gun with us, because sometimes you find a cow or a calf that is so badly injured that it needs to be put out of its misery. Mm-hmm. My father never, several times we had to come back to get when we found some. We had to come back and get a weapon. All my father's only weapon was a .22 rifle, a little .22 single-shot rifle. Well, George had bigger armament than that, and he also never went anywhere without a sharp knife. Mm-hmm. So I learned to carry those things out of necessity.
Right.
This is somewhat off the subject, but I've read all kinds of letters to the editor when people said, oh, I found this deer wounded on the highway, and it was just so terrible, and I sat with it until it died. Well, and you didn't put it out of its misery because, and sometimes the person says, I didn't know anything about it. I carry a sharp knife in my car. Mm-hmm. I have killed deer that had broken legs on the highway. Why let them suffer?
Right.
If somebody comes along and thinks that's a bad idea, then arrest me. But why let that animal suffer? And some jerk hit it and drove off.
Sure.
You know, I think that's part of my responsibility as a driver.
Well, and thinking about a gun and a knife as merely a tool is part of your animal husbandry is changes the whole conversation. It's not
yes,
a weapon.
It does.
You know, it's not a weapon.
It's
and
a
so
tool.
It's different. What sparks your creativity?
Just about anything some days.
Mm. And what shuts you down creatively?
Having a meeting. Having to be somewhere at a particular time can ruin the whole day for me.
Man, yeah.
Sorry. Nothing personal, you understand?
No. I don't take it personally. As someone who attends a large amount of meetings, I do not find them a creative experience, so it resonates with me. When art is not the only thing we live in, how does it, you know, how can we be working artists, quote unquote, you know?
And here's another aspect of that. It's so easy. I mean, I have a fairly clear idea of what I'm good at now and what I enjoy doing. So I just go ahead and do it. And I don't think much about it until someone like you comes along and starts asking me questions about why I do it. Which is one of the reasons I do these things, even though I'm very uncomfortable when being interviewed and always feel like I'm skating over or not saying, you know, leaving things out, all that sort of thing, you know, all the misgivings people have. But it's good to be asked, why do you do this and how do you do this? Because it makes us think about it too.
Yeah, it's so interesting to hear other people's process, and I think it's easy to get lost as an artist. You start to work in a vacuum, and it feels like, what's the point of this, and who cares? And you know, maybe I should just do my day job and be a normal person.
Well, and the other side of this is, I now have 15 books out. And one of the things I noticed, like in that Rhodes Scholar class this morning, these people were looking at the books and saying, my God, that's a lot of books. Well, you know, there's people who have written a lot more books than that. But there's this perception that now it's easy for me, that I just sit down and peel off another book or peel off another poem. It hasn't gotten any easier. I mean, some aspects have gotten easier. I think I'm better at editing myself. I'm better at catching things. But I still, when I work with students, a lot of times I'll go back up to my own study and look at my thing and think, oh, I'm doing the same thing I was just telling her she shouldn't do, which is one of the reasons I like to work with students. Mm-hmm. But all of these reminders are good, that it's just not that easy. But as soon as you get a few books out, people think, oh, well, you know, they're a success. They don't fail. I fail at plenty of things. But I keep doing it because, and maybe because I don't know how to do anything else. But
well, and it's great to hear that. Yes, with the amount of work that you have published, there is a little bit of a, like, wow, she's really got this licked, you know? And so it's good to know that, it's both good and bad to know that it doesn't always get easier.
I mean, one other thing that won't be all that encouraging either is that I would be starving to death if I had to make a living off my books.
Mm-hmm.
And I am actually very fortunate in the position that I am because I have income from other sources. But I also consciously have made decisions about jobs I would and would not do. I mean, I mentioned that I decided I was not going to teach high school or younger anymore, that I just didn't have the patience for it, and I wasn't going to do it. But I missed teaching, so I'm glad to be able to teach somewhat again. But I'm glad not to have to do it full time.
And yet, the choice for you is not about working for a paycheck at the exclusion of your writing. You're doing both of these things.
Yeah. But I'm able to do both of things partly because I have an extra income here,
right,
and there. So,
right.
So I always am very grateful for that and don't feel smug about it at all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I want to ask you, I've been fortunate enough to see you perform a few times, and you have a very distinctive performing style.
Oh, really?
Style.
The alcohol? Did
yeah,
you?
Oh, yeah.
Cool.
And it's in large part also why I wanted to talk to you. I feel like you really are a performer, which is
I learned that there.
Which is really, it's really great. And as someone who came to cowboy poetry really knowing nothing, the way that you are as a performer really hooked me in. It brought me into the work. And I think that's one of the really fascinating things to me about the gatherings, is it, as we say in actor land, you guys really lifted off the page. And I wonder about your process in that. How much thought goes into that? Is that all really just intuitive? Is it something you've developed? But I also wonder, too, about do certain pieces feel like they're pieces that are performative while others feel like maybe they're just for the page?
I misspoke a moment ago. I didn't really learn it at ELCO. I had started to work on it before that. I was a veteran of going around to schools in academic settings and giving readings there. And after a while, I started to notice that a lot of the people that I read with would read like this. Looking down at the book as though this was nothing. And I mean, I think this might even be sort of a reverse snobism, because they obviously felt well enough about their work to publish it and print it, and these were professors. But I think they didn't want to emote because it would seem phony or it would seem too much like acting. And I started I started with a particular poem that was I remember this distinctly. When I decided that I wasn't going to do this anymore, that I was the 10th reader,
the
10th reader of poetry on this particular performance, which got to be bad anyway. And they had all stood up and done something like this, except for, you got to watch out in the Northern Plains, there's all these Lutheran poets who get up and sing.
Wow.
And they can sing. They've been in the choir, you know? So they, well, I can't compete with that. So I was sitting there thinking, what am I going to do? And I have this poem called Tomboy. Boys never make passes at girls who wear glasses. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Boys never make passes at girls who wear glasses. And I remember having that yelled at me on the school grounds, and that's what that poem is about. And I got up and did it like that, and the crowd woke up. I mean, after 10 readers, you know, there were people dying there. They were, and then we all lined up behind our little desks to sign books afterward, and everybody lined up in front of me. And I thought, you've got something here, Hazelstrom. You figured something out. I don't think I've ever been invited back to that school again, come to think of it. But it wasn't too long after that that I went to the Cowboy Gathering for the first time, and I thought, oh, and I was scornful. I said, what do? Check your calluses at the door or something? I mean, how do we know that you're a cowboy here? But I saw people who were genuinely from the working class and working ranching class, but who were up there enjoying themselves. And that's when it started to hit me. If I'm not enjoying myself up there, you're not going to enjoy yourself in the audience. Mm-hmm. So I thought, and my father had always accused me of being a ham. I was so shy in high school, I couldn't go into a room. I wouldn't read, I wouldn't do all this. By this time, I'd gotten over it. And I thought, you know, when you're up there in that spotlight, you have to enjoy it. You have to be flamboyant. And yes, there's certain pieces that work better than others. There's certain pieces I've never read at the gathering. I've tried the last few years to read kind of new stuff there and to do more of what Bess Quinlan calls writing your own work, women's work and women's poems. And those seem to be well received too. But the ones that really get them are the ones where you really are doing a performance. Mm-hmm. I've got one in that involves that they love. I haven't done it for several years because it takes a lot out of you. But it's in the voice of a man that I heard, and I can hear his voice in my head every time I do that poem. So, but it's fun.
Yeah.
Some poets really resent. I've had several questions about this, about speaking about poetry as performance. And to me, that's one of the distinctions between cowboy poetry, that it is partly a performance art, and that's all right. Mm-hmm. But there are going to remain poets who believe that it's on the page, and that's mm-hmm. the only place it is. That's fine.
It is fine. It is fine. I will say, again, the fact that you all just brought it right off the page is, I think, what it hooked me. I don't know that I would have gone out and thought, I should buy a book of uh-huh. cowboy poetry. That sounds like that, you know, that's really going to get me. I would have thought, that's not for me. I don't know anything about that.
Well, and something else just occurred to me. I've been, can you picture Emily Dickinson standing up on a stage and reading her poems? Maybe it would be wonderful, but I can't.
No.
Those are not poems that I think are made to be stood up and declaimed. Mm-hmm. They're poems that you read quietly to yourself and mm-hmm. think about. So I think there's maybe a difference in writing, too. Mm-hmm. But when Yvonne Hollenbeck writes about what she said to her husband, you know, I can hear her saying that. Mm-hmm. And Elizabeth, same.
Mm-hmm. That it's a question that I pose to lots of artists working in various modalities, but how much do you consider your audience?
Gertrude Stein said, I write for myself and others. The others, dear reader, are an afterthought. When I start writing, it's because I have something that I want to, usually, to figure out. Sometimes that I want to figure out about myself or something that I don't understand. And I write, work on several drafts that way. And then I start thinking, okay, now, if I'm reading this, what is it that I need to know? Or what is it that, am I insulting anybody? Am I not giving information I need to give? But it's well into the drafts before I do that. Mm. Which sounds really selfish, doesn't it?
No.
I mean, a lot of times what I'm trying to think of an example. Okay, I had a very large disappointment a week or so ago. Project I've been working on for a couple of years arrived. It had not been done in the way that I thought had been agreed to do it. I was very unhappy with it. I was furious. My wise partner made me go out in the woods with him to find pieces of wood for his furniture business. So I was out in the sun, stomping around in the woods, trying to find twisted pieces of pine. And I got all involved in how beautiful it was, the sunshine and the flowers, and got to thinking, well, you know, my dad used to say, it won't matter in a year, it won't matter in 5 years, in 10 years you won't even remember it. That was pretty smart. And by the time the day ended, I thought, okay, I can go back, I can argue with the person whose responsibility this was, and spend the next couple of weeks screaming back and forth and emails and stuff. Or I can just say, okay, that's it, let's get on with it. I said, okay, that's it, let's get on with it. I'm a lot happier. I mean, the writing, and then I wrote about all this. And the reason I wrote about it is that I hope that someone else, I mean, that was my issue, my problem. I hope that someone else, when they read it, will say, okay, well, okay, so that didn't work out, but it's not worth tearing my hair out over.
Mm-hmm. I like audiences' afterthoughts.
Well, and it's not that I don't think of them. And I want people to read my stuff, and I love it when someone says, I have a WordPress blog, and I do write things on Facebook. Sometimes I write little things on Facebook just about my morning. It's always intriguing how many people just bing, 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 write back and say, oh, that's so beautiful. And I think, you're sitting in an office, and you're not able to observe what I'm doing, what I'm seeing. So I partly do it as a gift. you know, and hope that someone will read it and enjoy it and feel better about their day.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's wonderful to have that, but I mostly do it for myself. Make a hand, my father hollered when my friends came down to visit. Almost everyone I knew would come to help us just so they could nod when conversations turned to ranching. Make a hand! He didn't care if they were men or women when we needed help. This job's beyond an old man and a crippled girl, he'd say. Make a hand and drive those yearlings up the chute so we can take them to the sale. Your mother wants new carpet, but I think I'll get a truck. Gender issues didn't surface, not until we got around to branding. Even then, he didn't call them that. He'd just yell, make a hand! And startle a romantic poet who'd never had a callus, who spent his nights consulting with his muse, a scribbler whose idea of work was sitting by a candle sighing while he doodled at his latest masterpiece, a villanelle on spring and love. Make a hand! That skinny poet vaulted over an 8-foot plank fence when he heard it. The writer grabbed a calf's tail, frozen short the night his mother birthed him, March and 42 below. An artist slammed the headgate, flipped the calf, and held him while I laid a red-hot iron against his ribs. Before that calf discovered his potential, he had lost them both, was branded, ear-tagged, and received his shots and lurched away. The poet headed back to get another critter, jeans still oozing with authentic green manure, as Dad yelled, "Make a hand!" It's been 6 years or better since we closed the box, that narrow casket where he finally took his rest. We tamped the yellow gumbo down that summer, filled and tamped some more come spring. I planted wild blue flax, brought plugs of red top from the pasture, big and little blue stem. Found a sago lily like the ones he brought my mother every spring. The gumweed flourished, creeping Jenny, thistles. When I yanked them out barehanded, I could hear him mutter that I should be wearing gloves. Make a hand, I hear him shout when I quit work and wander out to see if I've got mail today. Make a hand, he bellers, when I sit to read a bit of some new book before I start our lunch. Make a hand, he hollers, when I'm waking or asleep. He treated me no different than the son he never had. He scrimped and saved and criticized until the day he died, dropping dead outside the kitchen door the way he always said he wanted to. He left the ranch to mother, even though she hated it, and had no man to help her. I got nothing, but I helped her sort the mess he left, found money in the rafters, deeds stuffed inside a garbage can beneath the cellar steps. I put her money in a trust so she could have the care she needs in that new nursing home in town. I added up the debts and stood beside his grave and cussed him hard. I took a deep breath, got a loan, and bought the ranch. And every time I step outside, I hear the echoes, "Make a hand!" I also have to say a guarded thank you for this experience, which is the first time I have ever read that poem in this house with the back step where my father dropped dead 10 feet away. So that was interesting. And this is where the dining room table was, where he always sat. I'm not feeling any great waves of disapproval, so maybe it was all right.
Good.
There it is. Honesty. That final moment with Linda really got me. I mean, I felt it in my heart and hard. It so encapsulates what artists hear all the time. Write, paint, dance, what you know. She certainly does write what she knows. Be it about her long-gone father, the weather, the vegetables she plants, the men she no longer trusts, or the animals she loves. Her brand of honesty feels fierce and tender simultaneously. It's the kind of honesty that allows us, the reader, to find ourselves in her work, even if it seems there's nothing on the surface in common. Today, the train into the city was packed, and I found myself frustrated by the crowd. But then my mind turned to Linda and some of her work. And as I looked around, really noticing all the different people, couldn't help but wonder just how much I might share in common with these particular folks in just this moment. I'm thankful for that little shift away from myself and toward my humanity. And thank you for listening. You can learn more about our show, Cowboy Poets, and see pictures of my travels on thecowboypages.com.